This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, January 5, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Starting today, foreign visitors are being fingerprinted and photographed on entry into the United States. The Iranian city of Bam is beginning to take stock of extensive damage and death toll from last week's earthquake. And we visit a memorial to remember American soldiers who've died in Iraq. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The leaders of nuclear neighbors India and Pakistan met face-to-face today in a historic meeting. Masroor Hussain reports from Islamabad.
There's no official word on the meeting between Indian Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee and Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf, but diplomatic sources here in Islamabad say Vajpayee and Musharraf laid emphasis on the need for mutual resolution of issues and continuation of dialogue between the leaders of both governments. The meeting is seen as a milestone event as it symbolizes thaw in the hostile relations between two nuclear powers. India and Pakistan have fought three wars in the last 50 years and in 2001 came close to a fourth one. One-fifth of the world's poor live in India and Pakistan. A major cause of their poverty is huge military expenditure by the two governments. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Masroor Hussain in Islamabad.
Afghanistan's Loya Jirga, or Assembly, has accepted a draft constitution granting the to-be-elected president vast powers. Both the Bush administration and their chosen leader in Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, agree that the nation should have a weaker parliament to a strong-handed president. The historic assembly came close to collapsing as they wrestled with the demands of minorities, women, and other interest groups since its beginning on December 14th. In the end, the Constitution grants equal rights to men and women, and minority languages in the North will receive official status. Sidestepping the issue of adopting Islamic law, the Constitution states that no Afghan law can be contrary to the beliefs and provisions of Islam. And the nation of Georgia has a new president, Mikhail Saakashvili. The U.S. educated lawyer is considered to have pro-Western views, but also has recommitted to a relationship with Russia. Officials in Moscow are reportedly wary of Saakashvili, concerned that the Georgian leader will support Chechen separatism. Georgian officials are equally concerned about possible Russian instigation to destabilize the region in order to obtain more political influence. Georgia is considered strategically valuable for linking oil transport from the Caspian Sea to the Mediterranean. Thailand has declared martial law in its southernmost provinces after deadly attacks for 2 days straight. From Bangkok, Dwali Saikautau has more.
Three of Thailand's four southern provinces bordering Malaysia have been put under martial law after police and soldiers were killed in separate attacks. In Pattani, at least two police officers were killed while trying to defuse bombs hidden on a motorcycle. Police say two additional bombs were defused before they could go off. In Nalathiwat, a province near Pattani, armed bandits attacked an armory there and took off with more than 100 rifles and M16 machine guns on Sunday. The government blamed this incident on Islamic separatists. Security officials say unidentified insurgents are planning to start a war against the government. Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat said martial law would be enforced as gently as possible. Another government official told reporters that a curfew has yet to be set. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Dwali Saikautau in Bangkok.
A Florida teenager sentenced to life in prison when he was 13 for killing a 6-year-old playmate, could now be freed as early as next month. Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
Immediately after Lionel Tate was sentenced to life in prison for killing a 6-year-old playmate, the assistant state attorney in Palm Beach County at that time agreed the potential sentence was extreme and offered a plea he said was both compassionate and would satisfy the mother of the deceased child. But Tate and his mother decided not to accept the deal. Jurors deliberated about 3 hours in the trial before coming back with a verdict that carried a mandatory penalty of life in prison. Last month, a state appeals court overturned the conviction and life sentence, saying the trial court should have done more to determine whether Tate was competent to understand his case, including the decision to reject a plea deal. The plea deal is identical to one previously rejected by Tate and his mother. It calls for essentially time served of 3 years in prison, a year of house arrest, and 10 years probation. The original sentence brought complaints from across the country, and groups such as Amnesty International filed briefs on Tate's behalf. His mother and a family advisor had a private audience with Pope John Paul II, who also expressed concern about the sentence. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Starting today, foreign visitors from all but 27 countries will have their fingerprints and photos taken at the U.S. airport where they enter the country. The Department of Homeland Security says this will help combat terrorist threats by keeping better track of foreigners. The countries that are exempt from such procedures are predominantly from Europe. Also exempted is the U.S.'s northern neighbor Canada, though people from southern neighbor Mexico will be subject to new security measures. Last week, Brazil retaliated by requiring all U.S. visitors who enter the country to be fingerprinted and photographed. A Brazilian judge said the U.S. security procedures are reminiscent of Nazi policies. The U.S. has been at Code Orange alert level for 2 weeks, and several international flights were cancelled this weekend, while many other flights were escorted in by fighter jets. Mitch Jeserich has more from Washington, D.C.
Fighter jets could be heard accompanying international flights to Washington, D.C.'s airports over the weekend. And helicopters spent many hours in the sky looking for possible terrorist acts. Since the Department of Homeland Security raised the alert level to orange, the second highest level, security measures around the city have been evident. Evacuation of the Senate wing at the Capitol on Saturday because chemical sensors picked up traces of cleaning solvents, and periodic announcements at the Metro rail stations urging riders to look for suspicious people. And local television news got into the melee by announcing terrorist plans to blow up a plane over Washington, D.C.
Tonight, a city on edge. Security concerns at two busy areas.
Our top story tonight, tense times around the D.C. area. Security concerns on the ground and in the air show just how seriously federal authorities are taking the threat of terrorism.
Authorities picked up information terrorists planned on using the jet for an attack on Washington, enough to rattle some passengers booked on today's flight.
It's been very frightening.
Terrorists flying the plane into a Washington landmark like the Capitol, or blowing up the jet over Washington itself.
Not taking any chances on board those flights.
That clip that you played is that it is the use of sort of stirring music with kind of ominous qualities to it. I mean, that sort of thing isn't reporting of the news. That's staging for emotional effect.
Sheldon Rampton is the editor of PR Watch and the author of the book Weapons of Mass Deception. He says it's important to take measures to save lives. He also says with the little details given about the threat, besides the Bush administration saying that Al-Qaeda chatter level is up, that the Code Orange message will soon be lost. And Rampton says it's not without reason, considering political leaders often use fear for political gain.
The use of fear really plays well into the hands of a certain types of political movements, nationalist movements, movements that want to shut down dissent and that kind of thing. And this has certainly helped the Bush administration quite a bit. People who challenge the Bush administration on a variety of things can be fairly easily dismissed and attacked as unpatriotic.
Homeland Security officials were unavailable for comment. On Monday, airports throughout the United States have implemented controversial security procedures in which all foreign travelers coming to the U.S. will be fingerprinted and photographed. Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge says the security measure is meant to better track and keep records of foreigners so to thwart terrorist attacks. However, Rehab El-Moslemani, an Egyptian-born American citizen who lives in New Jersey, says this new security measure is not comforting for her. In fact, on Christmas Eve, she, her husband, and her two small children were held up in Newark Airport by security officials for 7 hours. They missed their flight to Egypt for her brother's wedding. El-Moslemani says she feels her incident went far beyond security and into discrimination.
I got very nervous. I was like, what's the problem? And they said, ma'am, we are very sorry. It's because of all the alert codes. We're doing that for your own protection. You'll be very grateful. I said, fine, do what you have to do. But you said you will accommodate families with young children first. And now you're making me wait an hour and a half. he said when they put my name on the database, it came out as a possible match for someone of national interest. And then an hour after the plane took off, they told me it was a misunderstanding and I'm cleared to fly. They tried to get me on a different airline, but they couldn't find me seats to get me to Egypt on the wedding date, which was December 26th. So I went back home at 4 o'clock in the morning in a yellow cab with two children, no food, no milk for the baby, nothing. And I'm very, very disappointed and I'm very hurt, very hurt.
I'm Mitch Jezerich for Free Speech Radio News.
The Iranian city of Bam is beginning to take stock of the extensive damage and death toll from last week's earthquake. We're joined from Bam by independent journalist Madis Keshavar.
I spent Saturday in Milad Hospital, which is the main hospital here in Tehran, which has taken a lot of the earthquake victims, a bunch of them, and it was just really a heartbreaking experience to sit and talk with some of these people, which ranged in age from a baby that was born after her mother was buried under the rubble for 5 hours to a 65-year-old woman who lost her entire family. And by and large, the devastation, I'm not sure it comes across properly with news reports and with people talking and showing pictures and things, but to really sit and to talk with these people, one really understands the magnitude of what's happened and the massive task ahead in terms of rebuilding both emotionally and physically from this devastating event.
Now, we've seen some 80 aftershocks in the week following the December 26 quake. What does it look like there on the ground? Is there more devastation?
The situation in Bam right now is still one of the devastation, although there's been many relief efforts and foreign groups that have arrived and set up tents and hospitals trying to get people some type of shelter. It's been an incredibly cold winter here in Iran, especially in the southern regions of Bam as well. And people are cold and are having trouble finding shelter outside of these tents, which don't provide a whole lot of heat. And so there's still major efforts going on within Iran, people collecting food and blankets to send to Bam, and there is some concern that maybe some of these supplies are not properly reaching and being distributed properly.
Can you talk a little bit about the aid effort that's coming in from around the world? We've seen President Bush tell reporters that the U.S. donations, the lifting of sanctions for 90 days, shows great American compassion. How's the aid being received in Iran?
You know, to be honest, Deepa, there's been such an outpouring of grief within Iran's borders and outside in the diaspora community for the lost people of Bam, and there has been, from the international community, quite a bit of assistance and condolences sent their way. So America is really one of many nations that has been sympathetic to the devastation and the earthquake here in Bam. And while I'm sure that the American public, which is a sympathetic public, is sympathetic, Iranians and Iranians appreciate it, they are considered to be one of the many other nations that have offered condolences.
And do people feel like there should be more aid coming from the United States and other wealthy first world countries?
You know, I think that people at this state, you know, it's been a little over a week, and a lot of the stories of what's happened in them are still trickling down, and people are still processing what's happened. In terms of aid, there's a lot of concern that the aid that's coming now won't be coming in a month or 2 months or 6 months and a year from now, when Bam's rebuilding really needs to accelerate and these homes that have been devastated need to be rebuilt, and whether the funds and aid that are coming are going to be properly distributed for these people. There is a desire for a lot of aid to be coming, and a general understanding amongst the population that Iran as a government cannot do this on its own. And so there is a desire for more aid to be coming, but there is also a desire for the aid to be properly dispersed and for the building codes, especially for these new buildings, to meet earthquake standards so that this type of devastation doesn't reoccur.
Yes, Madis, we're seeing many comparisons made to a California earthquake, which occurred only days before the Bam earthquake. And as opposed to the 30,000 that died in Iran, only 2 died in California. What policies or strategies are being put forward by the Iranian leadership to counter this should another earthquake occur?
President Khatami, upon visiting Bam on Monday, issued a statement at the airport in Kerman before he left that he was making a personal commitment to establish an organization that would oversee the rebuilding of Bam and to guarantee that the geological and geophysical, you know, needs would all be met in the future, because obviously they were not in the building of Bam, which, you know, it was a city that is thousands and thousands of years old, and many of the buildings, like the Citadel, for example, which held up better than some of the other buildings, but there was an obvious lack of contractual obligation there in terms of the standards for these buildings.
Mahdis Keshavar is an independent journalist speaking to us from Iran. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Hundreds of Nigerian troops and police have crushed a rebellion by Muslim youths. The youth are demanding the establishment of an Islamic government in Nigeria's predominantly Muslim north. The rebellion started last week with the youth attacking police stations and seizing arms. Meanwhile, the trial and conviction of three former executives of the French oil company Elf by a Paris court reveals that the company indulged in widespread bribery to get lucrative oil concessions in Africa. However, as Samuel Okoya reports from Nigeria, this is not an isolated case, as many other Western oil companies operating in Africa are also guilty of corrupt practices.
The former executives of the French oil company Elf were jailed early this month for embezzling money. It was revealed during their trial that the company kept a secret account that runs into hundreds of millions of dollars. The money was paid to government officials in African countries like Nigeria, Cameroon, Gabon, and Angola in order to secure oil concession. Oil industry expert Steve Ubana says this is not an isolated case, but a reflection of the corruption perpetrated by Western oil companies operating in countries like Nigeria.
The oil industry in Nigeria, as you know too well, is a haven of corruption. The major operators, in order to achieve what they intend to achieve, to get the best block, the best oil field, are trying to induce those regulatory agencies that are responsible in giving out these oil blocks to them. And how do they get this? They must service these people, these organizations that are responsible in giving the best, the juiciest oil blocks to them.
The oil industry in Nigeria has indeed been rocked by corruption scandals. The Anglo-Dutch company Shell Petroleum was recently accused of fraudulently acquiring a very lucrative oil concession that had earlier been given to a small indigenous company. Similarly, the American company Halliburton, which has close links with U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney, paid $2.4 million bribe to evade tax in Nigeria. Part of the proceeds of such corrupt practices is known to end up in Western countries where they are used for political purposes. Elf officials admitted during their trial that part of the secret fund was used to fund French politicians and parties. Godwin Uyi Ojo of Nigeria's Environmental Rights Action says this shows the global nature of the corruption perpetrated by Western oil companies.
Corruption is being propagated throughout the world due to greed, especially relating to the extractive industries. I mean, that is what is coming out. That is the experience we have.
But while Western oil companies repatriate money abroad to fund politicians, local communities are denied a share of oil proceeds. Funke Tonjo of Abitaye village in Nigeria's Niger Delta region says even though Chevron Texaco exploits more than 10,000 barrels of crude oil daily in the village, there is nothing to show for it. She says the absence of medical facilities in the village has led to loss of lives.
Some people, when they're in labor, they die because there is no proper care.
Oil proceeds from the Niger Delta run into billions of dollars yearly. Communities long denied a share of this money are now agitating for their share. Steve Ubana says life will be better in local communities if the oil companies give the communities a share of oil proceeds rather than channeling money into corrupt ventures.
What is happening in the Niger Delta today is an aftermath of several years of neglect, several years of thinking that these people have no say, that everything begins and ends with the government. And that is why we're having the problem in the Niger Delta today. I think If these oil multinational oil companies can reduce their expenditure on these policymakers and concentrate more on the communities, the problem we're having in the Niger Delta today will end.
But this is not likely to happen soon, as the oil companies have chosen to rely on the military to put down communal agitation for a share of oil proceeds. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
Following his US counterpart, British Prime Minister Tony Blair made a surprise visit to Iraq yesterday. His visit lasted less than 24 hours, and he told reporters that the war in Iraq was, quote, a test case for the handling of countries which possess weapons of mass destruction. When asked if he believed that weapons of mass destruction would eventually be found in Iraq, Blair said he did not believe the intelligence he received was wrong. Meanwhile, British Foreign Minister Jack Straw indicated that UK troops will be in Iraq at least another 3 to 4 years. And as the mounting US war casualties are absent from the airwaves, one man in Santa Barbara, California, has teamed up with local veterans to create a memorial to remember American soldiers who've died in Iraq. As KPFK's Jordan Davis reports from Santa Barbara, they're using the display to remind their community of the costs of the Iraqi occupation.
On the banks of the Potomac River in Washington, Arlington National Cemetery is the traditional resting ground for those fallen in war. On the beach in Santa Barbara, California, Arlington West is built every Sunday. Volunteers armed with rubber mallets pound 10 times on each white wooden cross, fixing it in the sand. Each cross represents a U.S. soldier that has died in Iraq. And today, there are 485 crosses to be put up. Steve Sherrill created the memorial.
I remember when I first got this idea, the number of casualties was 287. So we've come a long way in the number of sons and daughters that we've lost in a very short period of time.
U.S. casualties from the occupation have been largely absent from television screens and newspaper pages. Last month, the Bush administration banned cameras from shooting body bags arriving at Dover Air Force Base, or the wounded being treated in U.S. military hospitals. It's the virtual media blackout that prompted Sherrill to create the installation. The project soon attracted the support of the local chapter of Veterans for Peace. Bob Potter is the group's vice president.
As far as the Bush administration is concerned, these deaths are invisible, but we're making them visible by putting up a virtual graveyard.
As Potter puts a new coat of paint on a freshly built cross, the graveyard by the ocean has taken shape. Rows and rows of white crosses line the beach, and every one of them will have a name. Carolyn Rice, one of about a dozen volunteers, will place a tag on each one with a name, age, birthplace, and the cause of death, if available, of the soldier the cross stands for.
We had a young Marine come by. And he began going through the name tags. He told me he'd just come back. And he said, oh, I knew this guy. Oh, here's the one I was looking for. He died in my arms.
As taps play from a cassette player, a sign at the front of the memorial says that honoring the Iraqi dead would cover the entire beach. Passersby on the wharf scan the list of names of American dead, making personal connections with those dying halfway around the world.
My age, you know, 19 years old, there he is. That could be me out there, you know.
We're not from California, we're from Minnesota, so you go and find the ones from Minnesota like it means something more personal to you. It's overwhelming, that's all I can say. It's very sad. When you put it out like this, you don't realize, until you put it out like this, how many people have actually died.
I'm Anne Iskall. I'm from the UK, just outside London. I find all this very sad. I just said how moving it is. And yeah, is it worth all the lives that it's cost?
Again, Steve Sherrill.
This is exactly the kind of impact that we were hoping to have. It's been very, very effective. And I would say that the response that we get from the people is 98% positive. And this is like a slap in the face. I mean, people walk by and they stop and they go, oh my gosh. This really gives you a feeling for what 485 extinguished American lives looks like.
The Arlington West Memorial has been invited to visit several beaches in the Los Angeles area. and the Veterans for Peace National Organization has encouraged local chapters across the country to construct similar installations in opposition to the war in Iraq. From the beach in Santa Barbara, California, I'm Jordan Davis for Free Speech Radio News.
Finally, since the December 13 arrest of former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, almost one U.S. soldier is dying per day in Iraq. On the home front, the holiday season saw the country on high alert for a terrorist attack. FSRN's commentator from Death Row, Mumia Abu-Jamal, asked the question, are we feeling safe yet?
It's been 8 months since the Americans marched into the desert of Iraq as part of the triumph of the West in the now classic clash of civilizations. Since that time, the Iraqis have staged a resistance that has cost the lives of hundreds of Americans, sent the United Nations into retreat, and caused several nations to refrain from even attempting to intervene in the region. Americans started the Iraq War on a series of false pretenses. A, the war on terrorism. B, Iraq's role in supporting the jihadis of 9/11. And C, Iraq's imminent threat posed by weapons of mass destruction. The capture of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has sent the American media and politicians into paroxysms of joy. It's kind of like the second invasion of the country. The Hussein capture is of a piece that is a U.S. attempt at nation building. One of America's chief architects of the Cold War found this aspect of Bush's new preemptive strike doctrine wrong-headed. George Kennan called it a great mistake in principle. In a little-noticed item in the congressional newspaper, The Hill, Kennan offered the opinion that a study of history teaches us, quote, that you might start a war with certain things in mind, unquote, but inevitably nations turn to fighting for things, quote, never thought of before, unquote. Of the second Iraqi war, Kennan noted, it bears no relation to the first war against terrorism, unquote. Further, Kennan was harshly critical of the Congress, upon whom rests the awesome responsibility to declare war. But he was particularly dismissive of congressional Democrats, whom he called shameful, shabby, and timid in the face of Bush's plans for war. Kennan, 98 years old at the time of the September 2002 interview, was the formulator of the U.S. containment policies of the past 50 years and was U.S. ambassador to Moscow during the Soviet regime around 1952 and ambassador to Yugoslavia in the early 60s. That this unabashed nationalist conservative thinker is so critical of the present U.S. course is telling. Clearly, Kennan sees imminent danger from the administration's present course of action. Even with the capture of Hussein, does anyone seriously believe that the armed resistance to the U.S. occupation will cease? Saddam Hussein, president of the Iraqi state for over a generation, was not the engine nor even the spark of the Iraqi resistance. That resistance is fueled by the presence and the behavior of Americans in a foreign land. The resistance is fueled by Iraqi nationalism, not love for the Hussein family. Sold as the next step in the war against terrorism, the Iraq adventure is not really that, nor even nation building. It is empire building, with Iraq chosen to serve as demonstration model. The subjugation of Iraq is meant to teach other regimes in the region the meaning of American imperial power. Those are the real stakes in Iraq. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Kata Mesta and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. The technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Million, and Lindsay Benedict. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.